Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. If you love digging into the week's political headlines, subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our reporters take you behind the scenes of some of the biggest stories from the campaign trail to the halls of Congress. Just for our Inside the Hive listeners, save 15% on a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair with promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off 1 year of all you can read, watch, and hear.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Inside the Hive. I am your host, Nick Bilton. So we have talked about a lot of different topics on this show recently, from Facebook to artificial intelligence, politics to culture, even aliens. But what we haven't discussed yet is race in America. Well, that's going to change this week. I'm really excited to welcome Jameel Smith to the show. Jameel is an opinion writer for Rolling Stone. He was formerly a reporter for MTV News, The New Republic. He's worked at MSNBC, CNN, you name it. And he recently wrote the cover story for Time magazine on the Black Panther. He's going to join us today to talk about this very topic around race in this country, where it's okay and safe to be a black person in America and not be arrested or shot, and why he thinks that Ben Carson, who is African American, might be the most racist person in the Trump administration. All right, well, thanks for joining us this week on Inside the Hive.
Appreciate it.
The last time I saw you, we were on Love It or Leave It together, right?
Yes, in Santa Monica.
And I was trying to be funny and was not very good at it, and you were a lot funnier.
Well, we were on a comedy stage, so it was natural for us to try.
It was natural for us to try. Lots to talk about. I wanted to start with an article that you wrote this week for Rolling Stone called Where Can We Be Black? And it's a fascinating week, and it's a fascinating article in this context because you have both two African-American men who were arrested in Starbucks for doing absolutely nothing except sitting there waiting for a meeting. You have an African-American man who won a Pulitzer. You have an African-American woman who's headlining Coachella. How is it that we have this world that we live in today in America, 155 years after, you know, slavery ended, where there is such a divergent world for people who are African American?
Well, I think that people, first of all, are a little too satisfied with whatever progress we already have made. All right, so let's start there. You have a situation where I think racial progress is viewed differently by different groups. So whereas people who try and end, you know, generations of Jim Crow discrimination and you know, going all the way back to slavery and segregation, all these different ways that racism manifests in our lives in terms of policy and in terms of practice. And then you have people who simply just want us to all get along. And they think that that's the end game of the anti-racism struggle. So I think, first of all, we have to look at this as, you know, the fact that we're both, you know, from white and black, coming at this from different angles. So there's that. But in this particular case, with the Starbucks incident, I mean, you look at, you know, people, two guys who are there for a business meeting. Like, all of us have been at Starbucks for a million years. Like, everyone goes to Starbucks for all kinds of different reasons. You know, you go there, sometimes you use the bathroom, you go there.
That's why I use it a lot. I go just for the bathroom, quite honestly.
Yeah. You go there to sometimes cop the free Wi-Fi. Uh-huh. You go there sometimes to meet, you know, business partners.
Once in a while, you go get a coffee there.
But I mean, I don't drink coffee, so I mean, I can only speak for myself. I go there usually to, you know, use the bathroom, get the Wi-Fi, and generally kill some time.
So these two young men, they go into the Starbucks. It's literally 2 minutes from the time that they sit down to the time that someone calls 911. Is that – what is – that's symptomatic of something, right? That is there is something that is driving the person who decided to call the police to do that. So here's the part I don't understand. Is it the media? Is it just historical? I mean, you know, is – What is it?
Well, I can't get into the head of that particular woman who did that.
Of course.
But let's think through her actions a little bit. These two gentlemen get in at 4:35, walk in there, they're ready for a business meeting, they're waiting for a business partner to arrive for a 4:45 meeting. She apparently goes up to them and asks them, you know, if they want anything or if they would like to order anything, which, first of all, I've never had happen to me
I've
in a Starbucks.
I've never had that happen to me either.
So that's a tell that she's quite nervous about these two gentlemen getting, you know, being in there, thinking that, you know, for some reason, if they're not there to order coffee, what are they there for? She didn't envision that possibility that they could be there to talk about commercial real estate, but, you know, and so they... You know, they're sitting there, and then she, without asking them to leave, calls 911 on them. And very calmly, if you listen to the call, you know, says, you know, we got two guys in here that don't want to order anything. And you know, like, how is that something that you call the cops over? That's the thing that gets me, is that using police, essentially, to police that space so that it's safe for you and people who are like you. And that to me is what it really is at the heart of this. The first thing I thought about when I looked at this case was Tamir Rice. You know why? Because I'm from Cleveland, and I know that part of Cleveland, that West Side area where he was killed. And here's a young boy playing with, you know, a toy gun in public space, in a public park. And some gentleman decides that that is dangerous, or he's doing something dangerous. And rather than talking to the boy or trying to figure out some other way to approach it, he calls the cops. He uses the police to intercede. He uses the police as a tool. And we all saw what happened. I mean, you got to talk about 2 minutes, less than 2 seconds after the police arrived there, Tamir Rice is shot and killed. And in this situation, things could have been a lot uglier than they were.
That's the part to me that is so insanely mind-boggling, that the woman who called 911 didn't, that the thought process that went through her head wasn't like, oh, I've seen all these instances of young black men being killed by the police when they have done nothing wrong. If I call the police, is there a chance that that's going to happen? I mean, it just is, it truly boggles my mind that she didn't think that through.
Right. I mean, this is not something that's unfamiliar to anyone who's been paying attention over the last several years. I mean, maybe the idea of police brutality was something that was foreign to a lot of folks before, say, you know, Ferguson, you know, or before the proliferation of all of these cell phone videos showed people like Walter Scott and Oscar Grant and all these other folks dying on camera. But now you have no excuse, essentially. And she just obviously didn't care, you know, what could happen to these young men. She didn't care.
So how do you think that this is going to change? It's literally been 155 years since the Emancipation Proclamation. We've had an African-American president, you name it. Mm. And yet this is still essentially a massive, massive problem in this country.
I think it will change when white people decide it wants it can change, when they want it to change. Because here's the thing. Black folks, I mean, let's just first of all take the history of this. 155 years since the Emancipation Proclamation, right? But that's a very short period of time compared to the entire history of black people in this country, at least on this piece of land. So, you know, we're still in the beginning stages of this. I mean, really, we're talking about, 155 years since then, but only really, you know, a generation or two since the end of segregation. You know, that was the end of Jim Crow, which is rampant through, you know, not just the South, but also in, you know, manifesting its way in certain ways in the North. So when you look at the process, it's still at the beginning of this. And black people have led that process. that led that fight for freedom, led this push for awareness of all the ways that racism and discrimination manifest in our society. White people need to be more, I wouldn't say, you know, involved per se. You don't necessarily need to go to a march or you need to donate to a particular organization, but you need to be a part of helping other Americans who are like you, you know, essentially cede this position of advantage, of privilege, and understand how the everyday things that you, the sort of unearned advantages that you benefit from, are because of racism or because of, you know, systemic disadvantages that continue to perpetuate themselves.
Well, what's really fascinating is I did a volunteer program a few months ago where we went to a prison with Defy Ventures, it was a maximum security prison in Northern California. And one of the things they do in the very beginning of the day is you're there to kind of offer guidance and advice to prisoners who are trying to develop a business idea. And so one of the things they do is it's a very classic, you know, let's bring everyone together. They put – it's a big, you know, as you imagine in like all the prison movies, there's a big room that we're all in. It's like the rec room. And they put two lines of tape on either side of a line about 4 feet apart. And they have all the volunteers, mostly white, stand on one side, and then all of the prisoners, mostly African American or Hispanic, stand on the other. And then they go through these questions and they say, if this answer is correct, step forward. And so they have everyone step back and they say, if you like rap music, step forward. And there's a mixture of people from both sides. If you read a novel in the last year, step forward, things like that. And then they say, if you were tucked into bed at night and kissed goodnight and someone told you I love you as a little kid, step forward. And like 90% of the volunteers stepped forward and maybe 4 of the prisoners did. Mm. And I had this moment of realization there as a parent myself that the white privilege is not something that happens necessarily when you're, you know, 18 getting your first job or 35 getting a promotion or whatever it is. It happens when you're born.
Right.
And I guess the question that I've been thinking about a lot since then is how does someone change that who is not in the position to change it?
Well, here's the thing. First of all, you change it with, you know, you're a parent. You change it in the way that you raise your kids. You change it for the next generation. You raise them to understand the advantages, the inherent, you know, privileges that they have, and to help, you know, essentially work against that. Now, granted, you know, they're young. It's early for them to do that just yet. But at the same time,
my toddler just started walking, so, you know.
Well, get him on this, Nick. Come on. But, I mean, thinking back to your example, you know, a lot of people might say, oh, well, you know, parents didn't read them a story and tuck them in at night and tell them that they love them at night because they don't love them or because, like, you know, black life is inherently harder or harsher. Well, I mean, I think the first thing I thought of was, you know, black parents might have been at work at the time.
Yeah.
You know, or black parents might have been right where they were in prison.
Yeah, which is what the next thing was. Step forward if you grew up with one of your kids in prison and pretty much one of your parents in prison. And you know, it's a systemic problem that, you know, having Jeff Sessions and Donald Trump running the country is not going to do it any favors.
Right. And you really think about what they're trying to accomplish here. They are trying to protect the same spaces for white people that the Starbucks manager was trying to protect. They're saying, like, you know, it may not be 1801 Spruce Street in Philadelphia, you know, near Rittenhouse Square where it's mostly white, and, you know, we're trying to make sure that this space is safe for people who are living in this very ritzy area. But they're trying to make the entire country essentially that. They're saying that it's like, we want people who are like us to feel as comfortable as possible. And the way that we see that happening is by making sure that people who we deem criminal, people who we, you know, just assign this label to, are, you know, are locked away. We just tuck them away. We put, you know, put them away in society. We don't think about them. And they think that they're not really trying to solve crime so much as they are trying to, you know, create a new definition of safety.
When you think about, so I had Jennifer Palmieri on the podcast a couple weeks ago, who was Obama's White House communications director for a few years and ran Hillary's campaign and so on. And one of the things we were talking about a little bit is that Trump was a response. The Trump winning in many ways was not necessarily because of Comey, who we'll get to, who you and I both think is a complete and utter joke. we'll get to him in a little bit. But it was more a response to Obama and the things that he was able to do. Yeah. Do you think that, you know, there are a million articles out there that talks about, you know, Trump being racist and the things that he's done over the years to in his buildings, you know, not letting black people buy or rent apartments, intentionally evicting them. You know, I mean, we could spend an hour just talking about those things.
Right.
Do you think what do you think the reaction is going to be to Trump and the way he is handling the country? And do you think that there are things that he is doing now that are driving race into an even further divide?
Oh, well, certainly. I mean, I think that, you know, you see it not just in his reckless rhetoric, you know, but also most importantly in policy and in efforts, like we mentioned earlier, Jeff Sessions, you know, essentially signaling that the Justice Department isn't interested in pursuing police reform. It doesn't really feel like it's necessary, you know, seeking to put as many people in jail as possible, doing the best to criminalize marijuana, all these different things that they are doing to essentially with the end goal of putting more black and brown bodies in prison. You know, they're going for it. So that's exacerbating the divide, certainly in a number of ways. But also, I mean, look at what we just saw in Kansas yesterday with the conviction of three right wing militiamen in rural Kansas who were threatening to, you know, blow up Muslim, you know, immigrants in, you know, in a community there. And they are they're people who are, you know, quite obviously radicalized by the election of Donald Trump and the political elevation of Donald Trump. So this is a problem that we're going to be living with a long time after he is gone.
And do you think that there's going to be so if you look today, statistically, there's black prisoners make up 34% of the prison population, right? Mm-hmm. 6.8 million. And they, how do you fix that? I guess the question is it going to be worse after Trump for a long, long time, or is there a world in which we can kind of roll the disaster back?
No, I don't think that this is necessarily going to be worse after Trump for a very long time. I think first of all, it's for a lot of people, it's the same. This is what a lot of people have been living through, and frankly, as apprehensive as a lot of, you know, white people on the left are to Trump, I mean, they are getting a taste of what life has been like for a lot of us, in a way, because they are seeing, you know, what it's like to, you know, live under, you know, sort of in a state where it's just, you know, nakedly oppressive. And I just think that, you know, if it's a good wake up call. I don't necessarily think it's a good thing that we see that he's president. I don't think it's a good thing that he was elected. I don't think the society needed this in order to sort of get conscious about racism and other forms of bigotry. But I do think that it can emerge stronger on the other side. And I think that this November really holds a key to, you know, to dictating a lot of what's going to happen. Because I think that, you know, first of all, if you see the Democrats take the House and perhaps even the Senate, that essentially neuters the policy part of his presidency, you know, for the next 2 years, which frankly is exactly what should be the priority. And then as far as whether or not who will win in 2020, I who knows? But the point is, I think the Democrats to a larger extent, the people who are pushing the Democrats to be better, can take this moment and do something positive with it. But I think there's a lot of momentum that has been lost from the Obama presidency on a number of fronts, environmentally in particular, that is going to be hard to get going again. I just think it's a waste. We've wasted a lot of time with this guy.
But so the part I guess I – so one of the things I've complained about on the show since the beginning of the show a year ago, is that 91 million Americans didn't vote, right?
They
thought, part of it was because they thought Hillary was going to win, and they thought, oh, it's just another Clinton and so on. Part of it was that they couldn't get out of work. You know, there's like lots of different reasons, but 91 million. And what I don't understand is, A, why most of them didn't vote, but also why African-American voter turnout dropped so dramatically when it was so apparent that Trump was racist and was going to put people in. I mean, we saw the thing this week with Wendy Vitter, who is a judicial nominee and was asked how she felt about Brown v. Board and if she would support it today.
Mm-hmm.
And she couldn't say that she would. I mean, that to me is it's 2018. That's to me is more astounding than what happened in Starbucks.
Mm.
And so when you look at voter turnout for 2016, it was 59.6% of African Americans that voted, 65.3% white. It was a million less than had voted in the previous election. Is that because that they don't believe that it's going to have any impact, or?
I mean, I think that there's a lot of different reasons. Number one is a lot of them had their votes suppressed.
Yeah.
So let's start there.
Okay.
I mean, we're talking about, you know, Wisconsin, for instance. Wisconsin, you know, it's been revealed that, you know, several thousand more votes essentially were suppressed in Wisconsin than the margin by which Trump won. But going back to Wisconsin, I keep coming back to this one story in the New York Times that came out right around the election. It was before the election. In which, you know, they were talking to brothers in a barbershop, I believe, in Milwaukee. And they just didn't feel like anyone was on the ballot who could represent them. And I don't necessarily think that was about not having a black candidate, you know, on the presidential ticket. I think that was about seeing a black president for 8 years and all the different things that come with that, culturally speaking, all the wonderful things that came with that. But in terms of policy, in terms of actually making their lives better, I don't necessarily think that those brothers saw it manifest in terms of like their lives getting better. And they saw politics as this kind of wonderful showy thing, but it's not necessarily doing anything for me. You know, why am I going to vote if I don't feel like, you know, the politicians are working for me? I understand that mindset, but I mean, I don't agree with it.
But it seems it's almost like
I also think voting is a selfless act. You can't vote for what you need. You have to vote for what everyone needs.
It's like picking a meal on an airplane. They're all going to suck, but one's going to be a little better than another, right?
You just brought me back to my sesame noodle salad on my last flight. Oh, thanks a lot, Nick.
At least you didn't get the chicken.
There was chicken in it.
Sorry.
It was terrible.
Yeah. No, I do think that I understand that argument, but black, white, Hispanic, whatever, cannot comprehend how people are not, they don't see a candidate like Trump or even Hillary if they don't like Hillary, and they don't say, I am going to vote to do the thing that the people, that millions of people have died for in an attempt to do.
Well, but I see a lot of generations don't, we're removed far enough from the Selma generation that there are a number of young folks who don't see the sacrifices made during that time, during the civil rights era, as being relatable to them. And, you know, like, I can't get in their heads. I don't know their lives, mm-hmm. you know? So I'm not going to poo-poo it. But at the same time, I was raised by a grandmother who was, you know, and mother and father and grandfather who were all very civic-minded. My grandmother especially. And she, you know, voting was a civic obligation. Voting is something that is as important to us as paying taxes. You know, it's something you just do. And it's not something that you do for yourself. It's you do it for your community. You do it for, you know, the benefit of the, you know, everything from making sure that the roads are fixed to making sure your children are educated properly. there may be some people who just said, look, I don't see a difference between Trump and Clinton. And those people obviously are dead wrong. But it's up to the Democrats to motivate those people and to show them that they have someone worth voting for. While those voting, you know, those attitudes towards voting may be flawed, that is the framework within which Democrats need to win. And so it's up to them to figure out a way to do better than they did in 2016, for sure, because the message that they were selling, despite the fact that Clinton was one of the more sort of conspicuously anti-racist candidates that I'd seen, you know, at least from a white candidate in quite a while, that message didn't resonate because, you know, people were saying, oh, well, super predators this and all these other things from the past. And it's going to be tough. You got to have the right candidate. You got to have the right message.
Do you think that Obama did enough to try to erase some of the racial divide in America? Or was his candidacy something that in the same way that the Trump winning is organizing the left more, do you think that that his candidacy, Obama's candidacy, was something that rallied the right more and drove more division around race?
Well, I think about that question from a policy standpoint. I don't necessarily think it's his job to erase the racial divide from a cultural standpoint. That's just not the job of the president. It just isn't what he or she is supposed to be doing. What he or she is supposed to be doing is remedying the racial divide on a policy and structural level. And in that case, I don't think he did do enough. And I don't necessarily think that it's all his fault. I just don't think enough got accomplished in 8 years. And I don't know if enough could get accomplished in 8 years. I think you needed a good string of presidents who had, you know, at the forefront of their platform, the conscious desire and plans to remedy, you know, the wrongs of the past, essentially, to make sure that the housing discrimination was completely eliminated. Because it really, as my man Gene Demby from NPR says, it really all starts with housing discrimination. And all these different things that, you know, are within our society, environmental racism, all these different things that are built and baked into the American project, you needed more than eight years to fix that. And I think people had a lot of unrealistic expectations of President Obama in that regard. That said, yeah, there's things he could have done better. But at the same time, I think that people need to look at themselves a little bit more rather than looking to their leaders and understand what we can be doing in our everyday lives and in our offices, in our churches, in our synagogues, in our, you know, everywhere to figure this out.
It's really fascinating when you kind of look at the 8 years in which Obama was president. It was also the 8 years in which the smartphone and social media became a norm. And there's this moment that we saw, this kind of flash moment that really goes back to Ferguson, where there's this change in the conversation because there is video to prove that there is, without question, racial discrimination when it comes to police shootings and, you know, as you mentioned, Tamir Rice and so on. And it's, I wonder if, and I'm curious what you think, if the more we become comfortable with those, that footage, and the more we see of it, if it starts to, we become desensitized to it?
Yeah, no, I think you nailed it. I mean, I think, you know, the more people see of it, it seems like, and I wrote about this in 2015, you know, when we saw the McKinney Pool incident with a young girl being, you know, wrangled by a police officer in
wrangled,
Texas.
I think, beaten up.
Yeah. I mean, you know, just kind of yoked around and brutalized. And then you have, you know, Stephon Clark, you know, it's all part of a long continuum. And I think that the more we hear about it, unfortunately, I think this is a sort of a fault that's built into this American project. The more we hear about it, the more we get numb to it. And I say we in it as in a collective American we, not certainly not we in as a Black American we. We just are just traumatized by it. I mean, every time I didn't even watch the Starbucks video even though I knew there was no violence in it, I didn't watch that video for days because, I mean, I read descriptions of it. I read the news about it. I knew what had happened in it. But watching the video was just going to be a little bit too much for me at the time. You know, I just said, you know what? I just can't today. You know, there's days where I just can't.
Do you think that, and I totally understand that I've watched videos of, you know, just even random videos of cops pulling African-American people over and you see them violently beating them up or this footage that you see pretty constantly of someone driving by with their cell phone as a cop is like roughing up some kid on the side of the road. And it's infuriating and terrifying to watch. It's interesting that I sometimes see kids, African-American kids in LA that are like walking around with like a hoodie on. And I want to like say, what are you doing? Like the cops, it's like, what are you, it's, and it's,
but I don't wear red or blue in this town. But, I mean, I get it.
But it's terrible that we live in a society that's the thought process that goes through my head.
Yeah. Yeah. It is terrible. But at the same time, whose fault is that? You know what I mean? Like, and that's the thing. It's like
that's the question I asked you in the beginning.
And that's the thing. It's like the fault of it lies with not the people who are wearing the hoodies, not with the people who are sitting in Starbucks minding their own business. We should be allowed to be black in any space that we want to be black in. And because this part we can't change. This is who we are. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Despite the efforts of some, it is not something you can change. And this country, at some point, has got to become comfortable with our existence here beyond what, you know, our ability to entertain them. You know, beyond, they're comfortable with us, you know, when we're on a football field. And, you know, they're comfortable with us when we're on a basketball court. We're comfortable with us, even, it seems, when we're on a Coachella stage. But they are not all comfortable with us when we're sitting next to them in a coffee shop. And at the end of the day, you know, that is what has to change. And people, you know, who have those issues really need to look within themselves. And this is something that goes beyond race. I mean, think about, you know, this conflict in gender. You know what I mean? Like, men need to be comfortable with women in certain spaces. You know what I mean? When we just frankly haven't been.
Speaking of videos, the Tony Robbins video, did you see that?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. I mean, first of all, he just looks like he's an aggressive jerk. And second of all, like, what planet are you living on that you think that's so? If you're a business coach and one of the CEOs says to you, "I'm not going to hire this woman because she's too attractive," you should fire him as one of your business coach. It's like,
when I saw it just spoke to the ability of extreme wealth to build certain communities and to insulate you. And to allow for the fostering and the protection of certain attitudes.
Yeah, completely.
That are just poisonous. And look, I mean, you know, there's probably, you know, there's some guy making 30 grand a year who agrees with what Tony Robbins had to say. It's not necessarily all about that. But the fact is, you know, when you have that kind of prestige and wealth and, you know, you live in certain circles which are predominantly and overwhelmingly male, you get to, or at least you think you can, evidently, espouse certain attitudes.
Yeah.
You're listening to Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton.
Hey, John, I want to take a minute to welcome you back to the show, but I want to tell you a little bit about the underwear I'm wearing right now.
Nick, tell me everything about the underwear you're wearing right now.
I am wearing the most comfortable underwear that you can't even imagine. It's called Silver Underwear. It's made by Mac Weldon.
Oh, Mac Weldon. Know it well.
You know Mac Weldon?
Love Mac Weldon.
They are a sponsor this week, and I got to go to the site and do a little shopping, and I have to say, I have never, ever in my entire life worn underwear this comfortable. I'm actually like in the whole Mac Weldon getup. I've got a t-shirt on that feels like I'm wearing butter. I've got these amazing sweatpants, these gray sweatpants. The underwear, it's fantastic. The guys who started it are amazing, and they did it because they just were sick of dealing with the whole nonsense of, you know, buying clothes like this. And so they built this incredible website where you just go, you buy your stuff, and you feel like you're sitting in the greatest pair of underwear in history.
Nick, I'm not surprised that you're happier than your wildest fantasies could have ever assumed. The mission's pretty simple at Mack Weldon. I think that they make sure that you have all your basics and beyond, frankly, and that they're smartly designed and that the shopping experience is easy. And that, you know, people get frustrated with their underwear, and I don't know a guy who isn't, that now they have every sock or underwear or T-shirt option that is perfectly fitted just for them. It's a miracle.
Well, you can actually get 20% off your first order at Mack Weldon by entering the promo code HIVE at checkout. That's H-I-V-E. So 20% off. I mean, you could get a pair of socks for the price of a cup of coffee, and they will be the most comfortable socks you've ever worn in your life, or underwear, or T-shirts, or any of the wonderful things they sell. Once again, you go to MackWeldon.com. That's MackWeldon.com, and enter HIVE, that's H-I-V-E, at checkout, and you'll get 20% off. I can assure you, buy this underwear, buy these socks, buy these pants, all this stuff, you will be forever happier than you've ever been in your life.
This is life-changing underwear. It's good for working out, going to work, going out on dates, just everyday life.
All right, so let's go from black to as white as possible. Paul Ryan. Is Mitch McConnell whiter, or
I would go with Mitch McConnell there.
Mitch
but
McConnell
is
probably. I guess.
But I think it's a good contrast.
Trump is not. He's orange, so he's.
Trump is from Queens. Trump would like to think he's white and pure, but
no, not even close. So you wrote a piece a few weeks ago how Paul Ryan loves identity politics despite what Paul Ryan says. He has essentially spent his entire career trying to make life better for people just like Paul Ryan, right?
Right, yeah, and that's the thing. Here's the thing. One of the interesting and peculiar things I think about this right-wing attack on quote-unquote identity politics, which is ostensibly the politics by which we, you know, apportion, you know, various topics and policies by gender, race, however we particularly classify people. It's really interesting to see them complain about how that is so divisive and how it is, in fact, a detriment to our society, when in fact their policies are oriented almost exclusively to, you know, built in benefits for people who look just like them. And when I say just like them, we're talking about people who look and are like Paul Ryan, white, straight, wealthy, educated men, you know, and
with lots of money.
Yeah, yeah. And it's just the idea that, like, somehow if I complain about or I make mention of certain inequities that are, you know, assigned to a particular identity, gender, race, what have you, and I'm the one that's being divisive, I'm the racist, and yet you can, you know, proffer forth these policies that continue to, you know, further exacerbate and take advantage of these unearned benefits, and you are not racist. Like, how can you push for tax cuts and cuts to nutrition assistance and other forms of welfare, and say that you're not into identity politics? That's just, it's just an absolute ignorance, willful ignorance, about what America is and is becoming.
Do you think that, so Paul Ryan is thankfully going to exit stage left. God, please let Mitch McConnell go right after him. So one of the things that we've seen as a result of the Me Too movement has been a response where more women are running for office than we've ever seen in history.
Yes.
And I think a large percentage of them will actually win, or they will have a massive impact on the people who do.
Right.
There was some, it seems like based on just voter turnout, there's some complacency after Obama from African Americans in this country. Do you think that, or not complacency, but just a belief that their vote doesn't count.
Apathy probably is a little bit more on point.
Do you think that as a result of Trump and Sessions and the things that they're doing, and even Ben Carson, housing and so on, do you think that we will, and this is just a kind of guess as a prediction, so I know you can only kind of guess, but that we could see a world where, let's pretend that Trump doesn't win in 2020, please God, and that someone else does, who's on the Democratic ticket. Do you think that there could be a response where we see more African Americans running and winning?
I mean, I would certainly hope so. I mean, obviously, you know, I think it depends. You know, you'd see black women involved in this battle. You see women of color, really, not just black women, but, you know, Latina women and other women of color who are getting involved in this process as a result of this Me Too cultural push.
Mm-hmm.
And even those who were in it in the fight before then, like Stacey Abrams, who's running to be the first black woman governor of Georgia. I think that a lot depends upon how much success we see in 2018. Also, I think that people need to see on a grander scale politics as something that can do something in their lives, do something positive. We know the negative effect of politics, but people need to understand that it can empower them. And I think that it's incredibly encouraging to see as many women participating in this process as possible. But the key to this is all money. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
If there's going to be more money available for African-American candidates who are coming out of modest circumstances and want to make a change, great. You know, but largely, you know, if you're not somebody who is making a good salary and can attract donors, it's just a pipe dream. You know, I've seen any number of people, you know, people who I know personally get involved in political process. A friend of mine from high school ran for the school board, you know, and won back home in suburban Cleveland. But at the same time, there's a lot of people who I grew up with it just seems like it's too much to dream. I grew up in Shaker Heights, Ohio. It's a suburb of Cleveland, and was born and raised in Cleveland. And you know, I see there a lot of hope and hopelessness, you know, when I go back home. But at the same time, I definitely just feel like when people are inspired to run, it goes beyond just sort of like, okay, I'm a woman and I'm inspired to run, or I'm a black person, I'm inspired to run by a particular cultural moment. They have to feel like there's a change that they can make, that they have power to actually make this a reality. And until people feel more empowered just in general in this country, I don't think necessarily we'll see that similar jump that you're talking about.
All right, let's talk about my least favorite person right now.
Ooh.
I don't know if he's my least favorite person, actually. He's just annoying. You know what? the other night I was asleep, and I was woken up around 2 in the morning, and there was a mosquito in my ear, and it woke me up, and I was like, my wife was like, oh my God, there's a mosquito in the room. We're trying to figure out where it is. And I'm like Googling how to find a mosquito. Do you know that the way you find a mosquito is you're supposed to turn the lights out, wait till you hear the zzzz, turn the lights on, and hold a flashlight parallel to the ceiling to see or the walls to see if you can see the shadow of the mosquito, and then you kill it.
Wow.
Sounds like an awful lot of work.
That sounds very complicated.
But the mosquito made me think about James Comey. It had the same buzzing annoyance that was like, and I every time I turned around, I could hear him, but I couldn't see him, and I was like, what? So another piece that you wrote about is James Comey's infomercial, which I thought was fantastic. And is he the most annoying person right now? I mean, or is it just me? Like,
there's something about this that has bothered me from the start. Look, we're both writers. We understand that, you know, writing books is part of this industry. It's part of what, you know, we've gotten ourselves into. That said, if you have specific truths to tell about the president, about this country, about what happened in your particular position of power during, you know, this particularly momentous time, I just have something icky about selling a book to tell those truths. And like I got to go on a book tour and I got to have all these exclusive interviews. And it's all about, you know, it's all about the money. And as I wrote in the piece, it's like, instead of apologizing, which he should have done, he should have done that explicitly. And instead of apologizing and admitting that he was wrong to release the details of that memo, release that memo to Congress about the Hillary Clinton investigation weeks before the election, knowing that Congress was going to leak it. Instead of apologizing for that, he's asking us to empathize with him, but he's asking us to empathize after we hand him a check. And that, to me, is gross. it's just foul. And there's a reckoning that he has yet to accept that he would like. You know, I don't think Jim Comey, at the end of the day, is a inherently bad person. I don't really care.
No, I don't think he's a bad person. I think
he's trailing a lot of truths. I think he's weirdly, after being so averse to politics before, apparently he's now inserted himself fully into it.
Yeah, he's full. Yeah, don't give me the BS that you're like,
right,
I'm not into politics, and then go out there and
yeah.
No, I think for him, I think it's what's so frustrating is when he put out that memo, and even through the whole process with the fucking emails, those stupid emails,
right,
which now turns out that everyone on the Trump administration has their own little private email system, like that no one wants to talk about, that he was just wrong in the way he approached it time and again. Yeah. And I think that if you, anyone who is touting about how amazing Comey is right now, on the left specifically, in those 10 days leading up to the election, the days after the election, they were not thinking that. And I think that what is so frustrating is he's trying to play both cards. He's saying, oh, it wasn't my fault. It was an accident. You know, I was trying to do the right thing. And by the way, I'm with you now because I don't like Trump. And right. It's like, go away.
Yeah.
You know?
Like, and also, like, your intent. I think this is just a broader point, and it gets back to what we started this conversation with. Intent is so highly valued in our society. You know, we're always worried about what somebody wanted to do or what somebody intended to do. And we build it into our laws. You know, like if you intended to shoot Stephon Clark 8 times, you know, it means something more. You know, if you intended to murder Trayvon Martin, if you intended to kill Tamir Rice, if you intended to reverse housing discrimination rules, all the intent means so much to so many people, when in fact, it just, the result is what matters. And James Comey has yet to accept that the result of his actions may have very well swung this election, and to, you know, a president who appears to be under the thumb of the Russian Federation, and that's a very serious error that I think he's yet to really deal with. And yeah, and watching him do it in public, watching him flail in public is not a terribly interesting spectacle to me.
I think that he should have titled his book "Not a Higher Loyalty, but I'm Sorry." Then I would have been like, you know what? I'll give him money for that.
I would listen to that argument. But even the title "A Higher Loyalty," you know, it just it has a sanctimony to it that just isn't earned.
So okay, so one of the things that you've written about and I've talked about a lot is where this all begins, the problems in this country, and it all starts with education,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
And I would argue that we probably have the worst Secretary of Education in office right now.
Certainly the most dangerous.
Than we've ever had, and maybe...
I wouldn't say ever, because, you know...
There are people.
There are historians who may correct me on that record, but I think that Betsy DeVos, and I've written as much, is the most dangerous cabinet member that Trump has appointed.
I'm going to go with Scott Pruitt, but I'll
I hear
give you.
You
this.
He's trying to kill the
whole Earth.
I get it.
You know. So tell us why. What is it with DeVos?
Well, first of all, she is part of, like, you know, she's like at the head of Trump's project to build the worst government possible on purpose. You know, this cakeistocracy, as people have termed it. She has no experience in doing what, you know, she's been charged to do, like many others. But also, she has some really dangerous ideas about education that would not only serve to, you know, further exacerbate educational divides by community and race and so on and so forth, but also, you know, some of them are just downright theocratic. And that is not, you know, we talk about what the founders intended. That's obviously not what the founders intended. You know, she is a zealot for this school choice notion that has been proven to fail minority communities. And frankly, you know, her connections to, you know, through her brother, you know, Eric Prince of Blackwater infamy, are certainly not helpful either. So I just think that, you know, overall, I just have to question the sanity to a certain extent of any senator who voted for her, who thought that this is a person that should be running the Department of Education.
Do you think that, so, you know, fast forward, it's interesting when you start to look at the history of voting in America, and, you know, cabinet members and so on, you can see it's very difficult to put these things together, but there are these dots that point out, oh, the reason we are here today is because 17 and a half years ago, X happened. It's not, right. You know, the things that Trump is doing now, barring the fact of, you know, that Scott Pruitt is probably going to destroy the planet, we won't see the effects of those for many, many years. What do you think the effects of Betsy DeVos are going to be a generation from now?
Well, see, that's the thing. I think, actually, Scott Pruitt is not getting a whole lot done. Really, he's not, because he's just proposing things and sort of like saying he's going to change rules, and then they're going to get fought in court, or the, you know, stuff is way off. Whatever the consequences of his misdoings as far as policy.
Well, he probably spends quite a while shaving down the devil horns every day, right? I mean, that's got to take a couple of hours to go out in public.
I'm sure that can be very time consuming. But I think that with, you know, Betsy DeVos, I mean, you have, I think maybe the possibility for more immediate consequences. I'll say that. And I think a lot depends upon, frankly, you know, who the next president is and who the next Secretary of Education will be. Because I think, you know, those policies, anything they're putting in place now, you know, largely is, you know, either going to be held up in court or going to be, you know, fought, you know, tooth and nail by whoever's coming in, you know, if it's a Democratic administration. If it's a Republican one, I see no reason why they wouldn't just maintain the course. So I think a lot depends, getting back to this voting thing, on what people decide to do in 2018 and 2020. I think, you know, the people are going to determine the long-term effect of Betsy DeVos and Ben Carson and Scott Pruitt and Ryan Zinke and all these other clowns who are running our country into the ground.
What do you think, is Carson getting anything done?
I mean, he's making it easier for people to discriminate against people, of color, in housing. I think he's doing great things for them.
I don't understand. Does he look in the mirror and see a white guy? Like, what's the logic?
I don't know. People have their theories about Ben Carson, and I have mine, which is that he is invested so thoroughly in his myth of Horatio Algerism, this like pick yourself up by your own bootstraps, this kid who's poor from Detroit, who rose up and became the most famous neurosurgeon in the world and did all these great things, and, you know, gifted hands, and everything's great. I don't know if it's the God complex that, you know, apparently a lot of doctors have, but I think he's so invested in his own mythology that he is determined to be, you know, sort of like, I guess, the god of it, of that mythology. He is, I think the best way is to put it, I don't think Ben Carson, I don't really talk usually in terms of like sell out and, you know, want to be white and all this other kind of stuff, because frankly, I got enough of that growing up, and it's very damaging. It's just like, you know, and I'm not trying to do that to anybody else. That said, I think you have to look at people who are consciously doing the work of white supremacy. Ben Carson is doing that. You know, I don't know what he sees when he looks at himself in the mirror, but I definitely think that, you know, this whole bootstrap myth that he's got doesn't take into account people who were born without boots. And he doesn't much care about them. He just simply, he's so removed from that reality. And he's another very, very dangerous person to put into the kind of position that he's in.
All right, let's we have about 10 minutes left, and I kind of want to get your thought on some other folks in the administration, and then also
okay.
Is there anyone you like?
Anyone I like in the administration? Wow.
Any cabinet members, interns maybe?
Mm.
Cleaning crew?
No one? No. And I'll tell you why.
Yep.
Because they all knew what they were signing up for. They all, I think more than any other president in certainly in our lifetimes, they understood exactly the project that they were joining, which is one to, you know, essentially make this government as comfortable for, like we say, white, straight, wealthy men as humanly possible. And so that was what they signed up for. They signed up to be part of a corrupt presidency. They signed up to be a part of an intellectually lazy presidency. And we can, you know, the one of the weirdest things that's happening in political press, I think, over the last several, you know, months, is this notion that, you know, oh, well, you know, John Kelly will go in there and moderate what Trump is doing. He'll keep his impulses in check. There is no keeping this guy in check. This guy has been in the public eye for what, 4 decades? And has anyone been effective at keeping him in check? No. He is a loose cannon. And anyone who signs on to work with a loose cannon is going to be a part of administering the damage that he deals out. So, no, I don't, you know, it's not like whether or not I like them personally. Who cares? But I'm not saying that's what you were asking. But I think that I just can't really feel sorry for any of them. You know, I hear they're having trouble finding jobs now.
Good.
When they leave the White House. Fine. Great. You know, go work at, you know, go work in retail or something else. You know, understand what the other side, how the other side lives.
Do you think that that they are all in some way have the same viewpoints as Trump on race? They all have some sort of racist bent to them?
I mean, here's the thing. It doesn't matter even if Trump is a racist. They are doing the work of white supremacy. They are doing the actual work. So whether or not they feel in their heart of hearts, whether or not they see me in a Starbucks and say, I'm uncomfortable, let me tell the manager. Whether or not they, you know, tug a little bit tighter to their purse, or whether or not they get online and say really racist things on Twitter. It doesn't matter what they feel. It doesn't matter what they think. It matters what they do. And I think that is, you know, everyone who's listening to this, who thinks that, like, you know, well, I don't have a racist bone in my body. Great. It's not about what you feel or what you think. It's about what you do, what you put into practice, and about the privilege you benefit from. And so these people who may, you know, I go in there and be like, hey, I'm Jamil Smith from Rolling Stone. I'd like to talk to you about that. They may say, great, come on over. We'll meet and we'll have a beer and everything will be great. And they'll not say anything racist. I won't feel anything racist happening to me. But it doesn't matter. You know what I mean? These are people who are agents of racism and agents of, you know, systemic misogyny as well. So we're talking about, I mean, the president is a villain. How do we sign up to help a villain and not consider ourselves villains too?
I completely agree with you. I would never sign up, just for the record.
Right. Exactly.
So shifting gears here for a second, one of the things that we've been talking a lot about on the show over the last few months is artificial intelligence and technology, mm-hmm. and how technology and things like Twitter and social media, Facebook and Russia and you name it, how these things were all built with not necessarily good intentions, but boring intentions, if you will.
Right.
How to get laid, how to go to a party, you know, things like that.
Right.
And we now see that they are being used against our democracy very successfully by, you know, other countries and governments. When you look at artificial intelligence that we're building and it's currently being built, it's mostly being built by white men mm-hmm. in Silicon Valley. As you just said, they may think, oh, I don't have a racist bone in my body and so on. Do you worry that they are building systems in place that will inevitably have some sort of effect, maybe a massive effect on African Americans?
Oh, without a doubt. I think that, you know, if you don't have the people in the room building the product who have various perspectives, whether they be, you know, racially diverse or gender diverse or geographically diverse even, you're going to have a lesser product. And you're going to have a product that doesn't build in, you know, sensitivities to other people. And I think that, or in other communities. So, yeah, I think that, you know, we wasn't there like a Twitter thing, like, you know, where a guy, they set up the automated Twitter thing and it became a racist in like...
It was the Microsoft AI, and it was, it learned from the conversations it saw on Twitter and the conversations it had, and a bunch of not very nice little pranksters decided that they were going to make it racist, and so they started teaching it in conversation about Hitler and Nazis, and 8 hours in, it, you know, it come into the world as a happy little assistant that was happy to talk about culture, and 8 hours later was essentially talking about the Holocaust and race and so on.
Yeah, and anything that's built by people is going to have human flaws, and the best way to mitigate those flaws is to consciously work against them before the thing is actually produced to the world. And so what I sincerely hope is that these guys in Silicon Valley understand that various human perspectives need to be a part of that process. If they have any hopes of making sure that it's representative of all of us. Now, they may not have those hopes. I don't necessarily, you know, assume good intentions pretty much from anybody. So what is a way that we can protect ourselves against that? You know, can that be dealt with legislatively? Can it be dealt with, in terms of, you know, our choices as consumers? Are we just going to be subject to it, you know, without any choice in the matter? That's the part that scares me about AI, is the idea that I will be unconsciously and unwittingly and unwillingly sort of inserted into that experiment. And that's not something I've signed up for sure.
Well, it looks like anyone who's going to be using a computer or any form of technology will have signed up for, no matter what, which is terrifying. All right, last question.
Yes.
Are you excited about 2018? Do you think that the Democrats are going to pull it together? Do you?
I'm not big prediction guy. That said, I think that considering the momentum that we've seen politically, you know, the Me Too movement, the March for Our Lives, the movements to make change in our politics in this country, I think it's inevitable that people will respond a little bit more forcefully in November, certainly on the left. But at the end of the day, it's not necessarily about what happens in November, it's about what happens afterwards. And that's what I'll really be looking for, is to see how whatever changes are made, whatever promises are made, are fulfilled, you know, in the years to come. I think that, I mean, if I make a prediction, I definitely think that they'll take the House. I mean, we're talking about, they need about 23, 24 seats. And, you know, most of, you know, they have about at least that many seats that are in territories and in districts where Hillary Clinton won. I think people simply show up and are not, you know, victims of voter suppression. I think that it's a very big possibility that they will take the House. Senate possibly too, if the Republicans muck it up even further. I mean, what, Beto O'Rourke is 3 points behind Ted Cruz as we talk right now. I mean, that's pretty astounding. You know, and that's Texas. So who knows? I think it's the possibility is wide open there for the Democrats if they are smart enough to take advantage of it. But just they should understand that they should be willing to be held accountable, that they know, hey, we struck a blow against Donald Trump. It's not cause for reward. It should be the beginning, not the end of the struggle.
I hope that you are right, and I hope that more people go to the polls and actually vote. And it's only a few months away, which is terrifying and exciting. And
It's terrifying, but we've made it through the past 16 months.
We think we've made it through.
As of this taping, we have made it through.
We're still here.
We're still here.
There could be a nuclear bomb jettisoning its way over.
Well, we better upload this podcast pretty soon then.
Jamil, thank you so much for taking the time to chat today. Where can people follow you on the internets?
They can follow me on Twitter at Jamil Smith. It's at JAMILSMITH. Facebook, Jamil K. Smith. And Instagram also, Jamil K. Smith.
Nice. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to chat today.
Thank you.
This is Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton.
Hey, John, want to welcome you back just for a brief minute here to talk about one of our sponsors this week, Mattress Firm. They are the coziest, greatest mattress company on earth. Have you ever heard of them?
Are you referring to Mattress Firm, aka America's Neighborhood Mattress Store?
You have heard of them. You have. So they're fantastic. They take your budget as far as you possibly can go. Mattresses are really expensive. Mattress Firm, they offer lots of different versions that are affordable, that are so comfortable. They can give you a bed, that headboard, adjustable bases, sheets, you name it. They have the whole thing, and it's so simple to just go to the website and buy it.
Nick, these aren't just mattress purveyors. These are heroes of everyday life.
These really are. So what they're actually going to do this week, though, because they want everyone to get a good night's sleep who listens to Inside the Hive, they're going to offer 10% off with the code PODCAST10. That's the number 10. So PODCAST10. All you have to do is go to mattressfirm.com, put in PODCAST10, and you get 10% off. And they give you a 120-night sleep trial to ensure that the mattress you buy is so perfect, which it will be, and you get to save 10%. It's pretty amazing.
I'm so excited. I can't wait to order. I'm going to do it right now.
That was a fascinating conversation and shed a lot of light on a lot of things that I didn't know a lot about. And most of all, John Kelly, who I'd like to welcome to the show, on Ben Carson.
Thanks, Nick. Yeah, I wasn't always quite sure that Ben Carson was a white supremacist hiding out in the body of a African-American neurosurgeon HUD director, but I buy it.
I buy it, too. I mean, I pretty much buy anything from this administration, as Jamil was talking about. What do you think is going to happen to Mr. Carson? We haven't really talked about him. I think there's so many other villains in the in the Trump show that we never really get to some of the others, and I didn't really think about it before because we're talking about DeVos and Pruitt and all these other Mulvaney and the whole closet of monsters. What do you think is going to happen to Carson? You think he's going to be able to kind of stick it out?
I think Carson is doing a disappearing act. I think you're going to see more of that continue. I think that the sort of like next round of players in this, I feel like Trump's cabinet is kind of like Friday Night Lights, the TV show, where all of a sudden you have this this cast populated the first three seasons, and then Coach Taylor got fired, went to a different school, and then they got rid of all the other kids and brought in a whole new crew of kids to excite ratings. That was when Michael B. Jordan joined the show. So I think that Nikki Haley is going to be the big star of the next round. I think that the way she stood up to Kudlow, she's going to be a killer.
I want to hear a little bit more about Haley. I don't know a lot about her. I know that she is incredibly ambitious. But what is – can you tell me or listeners or whatever, what is the story with her? Like, how is she going to rise up through the institution before she gets fired like everyone else, or will she not?
Well, I mean, here, at least my perspective on Haley is that she was You know, she was obviously the governor of South Carolina, which is a fascinating job because, you know, South Carolina has more elected officials, I think, than like, you know, any state of similar size. So the governor is not really a big job there. I mean, the governor of any state is a big job, but it's not like being the governor of California. You know, you're not wielding a massive economy and or being the CEO of a state the way Andrew Cuomo is. You know, there are lots of interesting rumors about Nikki Haley's personal life. I'm not talking about the Michael Wolff ones. I'm talking about ones that you know. Some of them, pieces of some have been published. Who knows? She's an incredibly carefully managed person, though. So I think that she's an incredibly shrewd operator. And I remember there were reports early during the Trump transition that of all the officials who were being placed into these, you know, massive roles that they seemingly had little preparation for, like Betsy DeVos at education, that Haley was one. This is what insiders were telling us, at least, that Haley was one that they truly feared. Oh my God, this woman knows a lot less than we realize and is really unqualified to be secretary of the UN, which is something that she probably never in her life thought she would take up herself. But you know, Haley has so much of Haley's enormous national reputation comes from the very profoundly important way that she handled the Confederate flag issue in South Carolina. Anyway, fast forward to now, Haley is a well managed, shrewd operator. And I think the thing that's extremely fascinating that's happening now is, you know, she got rebuked for talking about the forthcoming Russian sanctions earlier in the week. Trump was pissed. Kudlow tried to reprimand her publicly. Haley pushed back and really kind of stopped Trump and Kudlow cold. And that was interesting. But what was even more interesting, to me at least, was that was a real inside baseball move. Mike Pence tried to hire a guy named John Lerner, who was on Haley's, like one of her policy advisors. Lerner is a never-Trumper, which a lot of people have been before. And Trump went apoplectic, and the hire had to sort of be dissolved. But a lot of people are looking at that move and thinking, is that some sort of handshake between Pence and Haley? Are these two shrewd operators who are sort of very carefully ensuring that they're not going to get so close to Trump? Because whenever the shit really hits the fan, you know, whether Michael Cohen flips, whether, you know, Mueller, comes bearing down on him, that they'll be relatively immune to the bad press and maybe have some political opportunities. I mean, some people are even saying, Tina, when our colleague published a piece about whether yesterday about whether Pence and Haley are even possibly contenders for a 2020 ticket. The only issue there, I imagine, is that they both want to be on the top of it. Anyway, that's my Nikki Haley download.
It's fascinating. I mean, I do think that that there's so much. You know, this is when the mooch who left Washington said that, you know, he gave that great quote to our colleague at Vanity Fair, that when you think of the worst person ever imaginable, the most vicious, vile person on Wall Street, that's the nicest person in Washington. I think that there's a little bit of that going on right now, and we're kind of seeing it in Haley and company are all in play. I don't know if I would give Pence, that much credit. I don't think he's as smart as he likes to think he is, but who knows? Maybe I'm dumber than I like to think I am.
He's a shrewd operator. I'm not, saying he's smart. He's certainly a lot of his policy positions are just like downright primitive, you know. And look, the dude calls his wife mother, right? Which is just gross. So there are issues there, but
you call me mother.
Proven to be. But I mean, he's always absent whenever there's a massive fiasco, and he's basically employed in the cabinet all these sort of, you know, donor fantasy icons like DeVos, you know, who satisfy the needs and itches of the Koch brothers. I don't think Pence has any chance in an actual election, but I do think that he's certainly keeping his options open. I mean, I remember Ashley Parker saying on a maybe it was. With the Slate Trump cast a year or so ago, that that Pence is quiet and secretive, but there is never not a moment when he is calculating his political future.
That's really funny. Also, he wrote a really bad book about a couple of bunny rabbits. But anyway, we'll put that aside. Yeah. All right. So last question before we go. Do you think that this whole FBI thing, Comey, McCabe, is going to continue to rule the news for the next week? Or are we kind of going to get a little break from it?
Well, it's funny. I'm sitting in my office here watching Comey on Jake Tapper. And what
wearing
I think
the same
more than
blazer
anything
that he's worn. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I think he needs a new stylist. I think that that sort of chic sport jacket that he wore on the Stephanopoulos interview, during the Stephanopoulos interview on Sunday night with the yellow buttonhole, he's repeating the outfit too much. And I think everyone knows you can repeat an outfit once, but you can't repeat it frequently, you know, when you're doing media hits. And so he's breaking some sort of cardinal rule there. But what's crazy to me is, I mean, you know, the Comey book has some news. I don't think it's as explosive as people thought it was going to be. But it can't hold a candle to this Michael Cohen storyline, which is just mesmerizing. I mean, I feel like that is where all bets are off. He's another date in court tomorrow, I believe. And you know, we'll learn more about what the FBI rated is admissible, what isn't. I presume at some point it's all going to be admissible to court. But you know, is Michael Cohen prepared to go to jail for 20 years? That's what Michael Avenatti, Stormy Daniels' lawyer, asked on NBC earlier this week. It's, you know, I think the possibility of a flip is certainly becoming increasingly vocal in news circles. Politico and the Wall Street Journal noted it in pieces late this week. If this stuff is real, he's facing very serious, potentially, you know, time. And, you know, that's a lot of ifs everywhere. Who knows? You're innocent until you're proven guilty in this country. But it's extraordinary. And this is closer than anyone ever thought.
Yeah, completely. Well, I look forward to no longer turning on the television and seeing James Comey talk about James Comey. It'll be a nice little break. I've never really yearned.
I just want him to change his shirt. That's all.
Yeah, well, we could come to an agreement and just agree not to look at him anymore, and then we don't have to see if he's changed it.
That's a good idea, Nick.
John, as always, it's been fascinating. This was a really fascinating show with Jamil. I'm really happy he came on, you should go read some of his stuff. It's fascinating.
I can't wait. Jamil's awesome. Writer. Yeah, he's a very massive talent.
Yeah. Till next time, John.
Nick, I will miss you every moment.
Bye. Thanks to my guest, Jamil Smith, and of course, John Kelly. If you enjoyed this conversation, and I'm sure you did, be sure to listen and subscribe to other great episodes of Inside the Hive with yours truly, Nick Bilton. You can find these on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or anywhere you get your podcasts. And don't forget to leave a glowing 5-star review when you're there. Thanks to the folks at Cadence 13 for their production work, and thanks, of course, to my sponsors, Mattress Firm and Mack Weldon. I will see you all next week.
Hi, I'm Michael Calori, the co-host of Wired's Gadget Lab.
And I'm Lauren Good, the other co-host of Wired's Gadget Lab. Get ready to dive deep into the cultural phenomenon that's been shaping conversations, sparking movements, and breaking barriers for over a decade.
The new 3-part docuseries, Black Twitter, A People's History, based on the groundbreaking Wired cover story by Jason Parham, explores everything from the fun, games, and inside jokes that characterize the early years of Black Twitter, to the social movements, the voices, and the hashtags that made Black Twitter an influential force in nearly every aspect of American political culture. Join us as we unravel the threads of this digital community, tracing its origins, celebrating its triumphs, and exploring its impact on society at large.
Watch the series from Onyx Collective in association with Wired Studios, premiering on Hulu on May 9th.